having been drawn to a character study of the disciple and apostle John for this morning, I was astonished to recall that in our series on character studies in various Old Testament and New Testament persons, John had figured before. But that was rather a special treatment, based on the question whether John was one of the two disciples of John the Baptist, whom the Baptist directed, you remember, to Jesus. John 1:36-42. When these two went and found where Jesus had his abode. The other, of course, of the two was Andrew, Peter's brother, as we're told, who found Peter and brought him to Jesus. And then later in John chapter 1, as you will recall, Philip found Nathanael. So on that earlier occasion, we discussed how we all came to Jesus. What circumstances and how and who brought us or whatever. And that was, you may remember, on the day of the admission of new members. Today we look at John as a character. Does it surprise you that John was very probably a first cousin of Jesus, as well as a cousin of John the Baptist, presumably? That should cause us a good deal of thought, according to our knowledge of the Gospels and the Gospel characters. First cousin of Jesus. In John's search for the ultimate in life and experience, in that passage in John chapter 1, we see him therefore appearing to have gone from one cousin, the Baptist, to another cousin, Jesus. And that's intriguing, isn't it? If we assume from hints that John was junior not only to his brother James, the martyr, you remember, Acts 2 and 12, but junior probably to all the rest of the disciples, that helps us to understand his special place. How otherwise would Jesus favoring John have been accepted in the group? Save that he was the baby. There would have been therefore, a double natural reason for Jesus favoring John. First, his natural relationship with him. And then his youth. And if all this is true, see how embedded Jesus' human life was in these relationships amongst the disciples and John the Baptist. He was not only a Jew, but his life was interwoven with these various families. He was truly human and had his relatives, as we have. I think that perhaps helps us to understand just how far our Lord Jesus Christ really was and is one with us in our life, sharing it. How could he otherwise ask us to share our lives with one another in Christian fellowship if he hadn't given us the supreme example of sharing fellowship, communion, himself? Of course, there's much more to John than that. By the way, the relationships between these men are obviously on the mother's sides. Salome, the wife of Zebedee, is generally regarded as the sister of Mary, our Lord's mother. So their mothers were sisters. So we believe from the scriptures. Look at, if you want to refer to the scriptures, Mark 16:1, Matthew 27:56, John 19:25. Mark 16:1 or Matthew 27:56, and in fact take them all together. They are hints that added together suggest. And John 19:25. John's father Zebedee seems to have been a well-to-do fisherman with hired servants, if you please, Mark 1:20. And Salome, you remember, was one of the women who provided for Jesus out of their means. Whether that meant wealth, it certainly meant substance. Luke 8:3, Mark 15:40, particularly in the RSV. Now, there are two very different character pictures of both John and his brother James in the scriptures, the Gospels, and John's letters, of course, and Revelation, and they both appear to be quite accurate. We talk a lot about impulsive and impetuous Peter, don't we? But Jesus called the Zebedee boys Boanerges, which is a strange word from the Hebrew. And there's doubt about its origins, but it certainly means something like sons of thunder, applied to fellows of fiery, tempestuous temper. Mark 3:17. Boanerges, they were the wild boys. Can you credit that when you think of John and the Gospel and the letters? They were the wild boys. They were certainly not backward at coming forward, as Luke 9:49 shows, when, you remember, they ticked off someone for casting out demons because he did not follow them. But you remember on that occasion, Jesus said, "Don't forbid him. If he's not against you, he's for you." That was a remarkable thing for Jesus to say to someone who in some way was dissociate from himself and the disciples and yet was casting out demons. And Jesus said, "Don't forbid him. If he's not against you, he's for you." Now, could you credit Jesus the erroneous ideas and impressions we have of the Lord Jesus, you know, and his Father God, and we associate, of course, as we ought to do, the two together? Could you credit Jesus with as magnanimous and liberal, yes, I deliberately use the word liberal, an outlook as that? Don't forbid him. If he's not against you, he's for you. My, if we apply that, we change our attitude to people. You know, we self-righteous, superior Christians, we change our attitude to a great many people at once. And be far more effectual for Christ in the world amongst them. We are so horribly self-righteous with our Christian faith and profession. Don't forbid him if he's not against you. He's for you. You see, that shakes some of us conforming diehards with our rigid doctrinaire attitudes to people. Some people, there may be some sitting here who would no more conceive that a Roman Catholic could be a Christian than fly in the air. If ever that was likely to be wrong, it's today when they're reading the Bible.
That doesn't make them Christians. There are many other things that may be signs. Now, I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about our attitude to them. Another thing is, we seem to assume that they couldn't possibly be Christians if they remain in their own denomination. They wouldn't like us calling it a denomination, because they tend sometimes to think they're mostly the church. But they wouldn't like us to say that about them. But you see, we seem to assume, or many do, many Christians do, he couldn't be a Roman Catholic and a true Christian. The church with its doctrine, so wrong, so against all Protestant and Reformed and biblical tradition.
What about our own Church of Scotland? Is it so perfect doctrinally? Or the Church of England? Or the Baptist Church? Is it possible to be a Christian in those denominations?
But what I'm saying, I know this is controversial and we could argue about it, and there's two sides, there are many sides to it. What I'm saying is this: our attitude can be so horribly self-righteous and superior. Jesus says, don't forbid him. Oh, let's rub that in. Don't forbid him. If he's not against you, it's fine. I suppose he implied that's something for you to find out. And be patient and wait. And shut your mouth until you do find out. In any way, you're not the judge. A verse or two further on. Luke 9, that was 9:54. You have the same two wild boys asking Jesus to call down fire from heaven and consume a whole village of Samaritans. That's our dear, loving little John, reclining on Jesus' breast. Lord, send down fire and consume the whole village. It's worse than the Nazis, or the Russians, or what people would do in Northern Ireland today, the IRA. Because these Samaritans did not instantly receive Jesus, and of course, poor things, they had a reason for that. He was on his way to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was absolutely hated. If he's going to Jerusalem, when we will have nothing to do with him. The Samaritans were brought up. The children had that attitude. It was inculcated into them. They couldn't help it. Luke says that Jesus turned and rebuked these two fellows, James and John. And a fuller ancient authority says that he said to them, "You don't know what manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man came not to destroy men's lives, but to save them." Well, that's your gentle John. Then there was no holding these two fellows as to personal ambition, whether it was put into them by an aspiring mamma, Matthew 20 and 20, or whether she, their mother, Salome, simply confirmed these two boys' desire to sit next to Jesus, one on either side of him in his kingdom. We may not know. There's hints of both, Mark 10:37. But what a thing to suggest of the 12. Me on one side and him on the other. Lord. Can you imagine Peter, always named first in the trio, Peter, James, and John, and generally their leader, can you imagine Peter saying to himself when he heard of their ambitious desire, "What a nerve, what a cheek, what infernal cheek from these two, my rivals." Of course. Nonetheless, there's no doubt about John's place, as I was saying to the children, amongst the first three, as we see at the raising of Jairus' daughter, the transfiguration, the Garden of Gethsemane, when Jesus deliberately chose these three and took them away with him for private communication. Each of these three occasions, the raising of the girl, the transfiguration, and the Garden of Gethsemane, each occasion more moving than the one before. Then Luke says it was Peter and John who were sent to prepare the Passover meal. Luke 22 and 8. So that you see, there's no doubt about the singularity of John's position on Jesus' bosom. What more about John? I want to go over his history a little more. Maybe you don't like history, especially history that goes beyond the Bible, but it won't do you any harm. In fact, it'll do us all a little good. What more about John? Well, he was with Jesus' mother at the cross, and the probable relationship between them of nephew and aunt would make that more understandable, wouldn't it? Although other factors may be more important than that. There. Then Peter and John are early at the tomb. Remember the race they had. And John was certainly amongst the seven who greeted their risen Lord at the resurrection picnic, which we read this morning on the shores of Galilee. Where also in that chapter, as we read it, there is a hint, verses John 21, verses 22 and 23, that John might live to be old, or at least until Jesus should return, whenever they thought that would be. You see, with regard to John living to a ripe old age, which is the general tradition, there is real difficulty. There is indeed conflicting evidence, although it appears very late in history, last century, some of it. Let's look at that. Did he live to be a very old man, John, as bishop, leader of the church in Ephesus, or did he die early, like his brother James, Acts 12? What do you think? Before we look at that, we have evidence of John's early struggles with the Jewish authorities, along with Peter, you remember, in the Acts of the Apostles. John doesn't appear for very long in the Acts of the Apostles. There's a lot about him in Acts 3 and 4. And then we read about him with Peter going down to Samaria in chapter 8, you remember, laying hands upon those who had received the word. And after Acts chapter 8, there is no record of John, except a passing reference by Paul to him in Galatians 2:9, a reference which indicates that 14 years after Saul's conversion, Paul's conversion, John and Peter were still pillars of the church in Jerusalem. That's what we know about John. You have him in Acts 3 and 4 and 8. And then Paul makes reference to the fact that 14 years after Paul's conversion, whatever that was, we'll not go into that, Peter and John are still in the Jerusalem church. And there is no more biblical evidence or knowledge of John after that, until he turns up toward the end of the New Testament, our New Testament at any rate, in his three epistles and in the Revelation. The latter, of course, at the Isle of Patmos, whither, presumably, as an old man, he arrived from Ephesus, where he was, again, presumably, the leader of the Christian church. Now, the late evidence that suggests that he died young is generally regarded by godly scholars as unreliable. It suggests that John died an early martyr death, like his brother James. Now, I'll tell you where this comes from. Let's work our way backwards.
Follow this. A 9th century chronicler reproduces a statement of a 5th century writer, Philip of Side. He's called Philip of Side. In the 5th century, 450 AD, which was discovered in 1889, that's not very long ago, that Papias, in the 2nd century, you see we're working backwards, from the 9th century to the 5th century to the 2nd century, that Papias in the 2nd century had said that both sons of Zebedee, James and John, met violent death, fulfilling, as he says, Mark 10, 39. Have a look at Mark 10, 39. Mark 10:38. But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking." This is when the two were wanting to sit on either side of him. "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism?" He means his death, of course. "To be baptized with the baptism of death with which I am to be baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, they didn't know what they were saying, of course. And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink." Now, the question is not really whether John ultimately died a martyr as an old man, but whether he died a martyr or a young man. Scholars are impressed, by the way, by the absence of any reference to an early martyrdom of John, either in the Acts of the Apostles or in the histories of the subsequent times, like Eusebius' history. And most of them think that if John had died a martyr in his young manhood, Eusebius would certainly have recorded it. And it would have been, very likely, in the Acts of the Apostles, as James, his brother's martyrdom, is Acts 12 and 2. But there's a Syrian martyrology. That's a list of martyrs with the dates of their deaths. A Syrian martyrology of about 400 AD, which includes this reference for the 27th of December. John and James, the apostles, at Jerusalem. That obviously assumes that they died, and very likely implies that they died together. But you see, none of this proves that John did not live to be a ripe old age, which is what the more reliable early evidence suggests. Here's some evidence from 3 or 4 men. And even if you don't know their names, they're interesting. Polycrates, bishop of Ephesus, the leader of the church in Ephesus, 90 or 100 years after John, in AD 190, says that John, who reclined on Jesus' breast after being a witness and teacher, fell asleep at Ephesus. Here's another great scholar, Irenaeus. He says that John lingered on at Ephesus till the days of the Emperor Trajan, and he reigned from AD 98 to 117. Jerome also repeats the tradition of this man, Irenaeus, that John remained, Irenaeus, you should pronounce it, that John remained at Ephesus to an extreme old age when, and this is rather beautiful, when he was carried to Christian meetings, repeating as he went, "Little children, love one another." And of course the epistles are full of that. Little children. Great, great, strong, brawny men. "Little children, love one another." Westcott, the comparatively modern scholar,
This is the last one, if you're tired of scholars. Westcott says that nothing is better attested in early church history than the residence and the work of St. John at Ephesus. So that's John. I couldn't imagine anyone not being interested in him and his history as well as his character if they love the New Testament at all. That's John, whom we follow through from his youth in the Gospels, his struggles with Peter after Pentecost and the Acts, and then later learn of him, obviously as an old man. I think perhaps this is the strongest evidence. Obviously an old man in his letters, his three letters, and in the book of the Revelation. Now, it's the two elements in John's character that we're looking at. That made him a wild and impetuous young man with his brother, so that Jesus called them sons of thunder. And the evidence of his mystical character and gentleness and lovingness. And allowing the Lord, as I was saying to the little ones, to love him. Despite the picture of John as an ardent activist. You know what that is? An ardent activist. Always busy. Always busy. Always doing things. Always planning new things. And getting them underway. Despite the picture of John as that in the Gospels, it's difficult to reconcile that young hothead with even the degree of mysticism that you find in John in his Gospel, let alone the letters and the book of the Revelation. You could easily believe that there were two men. In fact, some people say there were two Johns, leaving John the Baptist out of it, of course. Two Johns, some say even three. There was John the disciple and John the elder and another John. And this would be partly the reason for it, you see. Not chiefly, but partly. That there was such diverse, like John Sebastian Bach, you see, composed so much music, that they say John Sebastian Bach was a society of musicians, a society of composers. One man couldn't possibly have composed all that. Or Shakespeare, you see. Bacon and Co. and all that. You remember? That's too easy. And it's silly, really. Perhaps the fact of the seemingly very diverse elements in his personality, and most things psychological, interest human nature, surely. Perhaps that difficulty ought to help us to understand how complex and even contradictory our own human personalities really are. Aren't we not surprised at ourselves sometimes? And how in the world could you have done that? How could you think that? We say to ourselves. We don't admit it to other people, of course. We put such a brave, integrated front to the world, and even to our best friends, maybe even to our wife or our husband. But sometimes within ourselves, man, what on earth possessed you to do that? Because we don't understand ourselves. And how important it is, you see, for us to accept the complexity of our personalities, you see, in assessing ourselves, if we want to do that, and certainly much more in seeking to assess other people. We must allow for diverse elements in the same personality. And we must seek in our minds to integrate diverse elements in ourselves and in others. And this is very important. Let no one miss this. We must not sum up people so simply that having made up our minds about them, we give them a label, you see. We typify them, we type them, we typecast them, and we demand thereafter that they conform to our image of them, to our rigid and narrow assessment of them, or else, God help them. That's the trouble, you see, with people who become famous.
That's the trouble with musicians, sportsmen, I suppose, too, in a different sort of way. Musicians. And all sorts of artists, you can call some of them that, who become famous under a special character or under a special performance. And you see, anyone gets tired of one particular performance, you know, harping on one string all the time. Preachers do that, even if they have their own hobby horses, you see, and they want to change. Several times here, I've had an awful job to get some of you to accept that I had to change because God said, you can't get into a rut, you must change. You can't keep living without changing. And people won't let you. You must do it as you've always done it. We're so hidebound, aren't we? And we're that with one another. I've got you taped. Now conform. For good or ill, alas. Go on. Go on doing all the things that I criticize you for. Go on! We don't say these things, but we do act them, don't we? Whereas everything in the Bible encourages us bravely to accept all the known and all the possible facts about people, including ourselves, perhaps hardest of all, to help us to see God's ultimate purposes for us all. That he has ultimate purposes. Doesn't appear what we shall be. Doesn't appear to ourselves. Doesn't appear to one another what we shall be. How could it? Down here or hereafter? We've got to see God's ultimate purposes for us all, down here and hereafter, in terms of taking literally everything into consideration, even the worst elements and factors. This is why we don't get on with one another, because we don't accept people as they are. And let them be themselves. Look at God. Look at Jesus. His people will be bad. He lets them be bad. Else why doesn't he send a bomb to Moscow? Some of us would do something like that. When we hear the dreadful things they do, especially to Christians. We've got to learn from him to withhold judgment. Judge not. Well then, how far are we away from John? Let's see. We would want God to have every consideration for ourselves, you see. We would want God, really, when it came to the point, to take every diverse element of us into consideration and be patient with us. But why don't we do that with others? We apply exactly the opposite rule to others that we do to ourselves. Oh God, be favorable to me. Talking about favorites, be favorable to me, but don't have any time for him. Now we don't say these things. You're shocked at me mouthing and verbalizing some of these things, but do we not think like that and feel like that? I must be very, very odd if none of you do. Don't believe it. If we want the benefit of the doubt for ourselves, although there is never any doubt with God, then we must give the benefit of the doubt to others also. Do as you would be done by. Think of others as you would they would think of you. You see, it's a positively amazing, the ingenious rationalizations and the hidebound prejudices that we employ simply to refuse to see people in the round. Or even to refuse to see people at their best. I was thinking of a photographer. Now you go to have your photograph, a photographic portrait done. It's in the photographer's interest, of course. There's a bit of a advertisement to make the best of you. And so he, at any rate, whatever may be said about other people, wants to make the best of you. Not always true of portrait painters, but that's another story. But you see the point. A Christian should want to make the best of other people. And you see, so often, if we really realized what we were doing, we are taking other cats and stroking them deliberately the wrong way and expecting them to like it. It's too laughable to contemplate. We need to take people, as I say, in the round, and have confidence that God is willing to work and is willing to wait to work in them as he's apparently very willing to wait and work in us to make us what he wants us to be for his heaven. Perhaps to sum up this and get back to John, perhaps all the years that so many of us have been together here in Gilcomston, and it must be some kind of record in church circles, although we mustn't want to make a song about that beyond our own congregation, it's our own private affair. For all the years that some of us have been together, we should have some proof, should we not, against our expectation that some have stayed the pace and sustained the long struggle of many years of Christian attachment, whom we had thought in earlier years would certainly be put off and opt out, and vice versa. Some in earlier days we would have thought were certs as far as Christian witness and worship and service is concerned. And where are they today? We don't know. So, all that about complexity of human character. But what was it in John's complex character that enabled him to stay the pace, apparently, for so long a life? Patmos and all. The Isle of Patmos and all. I suggest to you that the answer to that question, what it was that enabled him to stay the course so long until he was a very old man, was something that is quite simple. For you see, even in his youngest, rashest days, and we've evidence, you know, in the other three Gospels of them, as we've seen, even in his youngest, rashest days, there was a unique bond between him and Jesus, which, if I may make so bold to say, I've said it already to the children, and I didn't know when I typed this out that I would be saying it to the children. A unique bond between John and Jesus that was John's own doing. Not that Jesus was unwilling. As far as the others were concerned, he never is. He never is unwilling to be chums with us. Nor do you think Jesus was less willing to be equally chums with Peter? But you see, Peter had so much controversy in his makeup. So much controversy with himself, making up his mind about so many things. And so much controversy about other people. What shall this man do? So much controversy in his mind with regard to Jesus. That you see that it was hard for that lovable rascal Peter to recline on Jesus' breast. You can hardly imagine him reclining on Jesus' breast. Maybe he was too old for that sort of thing. But is it a matter of age? Peter was too much an activist. Oh yes, we've said John was too. Ah, but here's the difference. Peter was too much an activist until shame after his denial cured him of that.
as you can see quite plainly from reading his first letter. It's good, you know, to read through Peter in the Gospels and in the Acts of the Apostles, and then go and read First Peter. And you wonder if that's the same man. Well, it isn't, actually. But that's another story. So here's a way. Here's a way of thinking of the complex character of John that makes sense. Of his character, that integrates his character. The character that sustained him for so long and fruitful and venerable a life. This is a way to think of him. It is that the various strands of his personality were bound together like the proverbial bundle of sticks. We're bound together by the band of love. And love is wholeness. That's the message of John in his writings. Love is wholeness. Let me illustrate. What makes for a happy marriage? It is wholeness of love between two people. Isn't it? No other affection intrudes to distract or to weaken loyalty to one another. And in that situation, or any other situation, everything magnetically attractable is drawn to it. And if I may carry that metaphor a little further, everything attracted to it, that is to love, is transformed by it into what I would call integrable or absorbable elements. You see? Think of the rag bag of oddities that we are here. Can you laugh? You don't look as if you could. As odd a bunch as you could see anywhere. But who's going to split us up? Eh? Let them come and try. It may be sometimes that we like our oddness too much, but it's not going to separate us. It's going to draw us together and enrich the fellowship. The greater number of extreme odd bods we have, the richer the mixture. Hallelujah. Well, now, see the point. You remember that Jesus binds, I think this is very important, and I want to say it with great emphasis. Jesus binds 10 commandments together into 2. And they're not really into 2, they're into 1, because you can't love God properly without loving your neighbor. That's not 2, but it's like the 2 sides of a penny, it's 1. Jesus binds 10 commandments together with the word love. Doesn't he? And Paul tells us that love is the fulfilling of the law. Indeed, the nature and the being and the character of God is summed up by John saying twice in his first letter that God is love. Was this then the secret of John's long and illustrious life? That he saw, even in his raw and his callow youth, that the greatest of these, whatever these, in any particular instance, may be, that the greatest of these is love. See from John's own first letter that love is not only the chief, the supreme perfecting agent, but that it is love itself needs to be fulfilled. If all other virtues
not to say our misplaced or our perverted propensities, but if all other virtues find their true place and function within the all-embracing virtue and fruit of the Spirit, which is love, then that all-inclusive love must fulfill itself in its own creative purpose. The love of the Father for the Son certainly found its true creative purpose, for it led to our creation. We are a product of God's love for His Son. And in human terms, it doesn't apply strictly, of course, but in human terms, that's what our children are.
Or should be. The products of the love of father and mother.
So love, you see, in us, if it is God's authentic love, must have its own perfecting creative purpose. That of love. That of loving God and loving each other. You know, old John was right. As they say, he kept saying to the Christian fellowship in Ephesus as he was being carried, you know, to the meeting, perhaps hardly able at his extreme old age to say more. He kept saying to them as he was being carried into the meeting, love one another, love one another. Assuming, of course, that that love found its inspiration and its drive from their love to God. Love one another, love one another. For love is the fulfilling of the law, as Paul tells us. Twice John in his first letter says something like this. First, in 1 John 2:5, whoever keeps my word, in him truly love for God is perfected. And in 3:18, little children, let us not love in word or speech, but in deed and in truth. Now take these two together. The first one, 2:5, says, love God. The second one says, love others. When you have loved God and your neighbor fully, roundly, without admixture of bitterness or contempt or selfish reserve or jealousy or hardness of heart, but with profound respect and genuine tender regard, when you have loved like that, you have...